Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the sanctuary for independent media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Austin. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, first, Mark Dunley talks to Nikki Cross and Ben Schwartz about why the climate activists want to reject a new project from the Iroquois Pipeline Company. Then, Lennox Aputo talks with Robin Martin about the rent crisis from the perspective of someone with a disability. Later on, Blaze Bryant brings us this week's disability trivia game with Max Rodriguez. After that, Elizabeth E.P. Press speaks with directors Matt Peterson and Malik Razamni, co-directors of Spaces of Exception, which will be screening at the Sanctuary on Tuesday, April 16th. Matt will also give a Be the Media workshop. Finally, in this week's episode of American Taste, Skidmore student Jordan Guzman reports on food insecurity and the importance of food banks. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports, the CEO of a mysterious nonprofit that was previously poised to get a $25,000 grant from the Albany County Legislature is being held in Pennsylvania on a seven-year-old warrant related to a stolen property charge. The group used the address of County Legislator Baroro Efikoro in its application for funding.
A new state law banning the slaughter of all horses for human or animal consumption went into effect this week. Advocates are urging police agencies to enforce it.
New York requires employers to offer health insurance to their workers that includes coverage for abortion services. A case challenging this requirement by religious employees will finally be held by the state's highest court 7 years after it was first filed. However, even if successful, a second lawsuit would be needed due to the changes in the law since the case was first filed.
Schenectady native Tara Vanderveer has retired as basketball coach after 45 years, most recently at Stanford University. Her 1,216 victories make her the winningest college basketball coach in history, for both men and women. Though University of Connecticut coach Gino Oriema will pass her next year. She won 3 national championships.
The League of Women Voters is calling on Schenectady Mayor Gary McCarthy to move forward with its nominee to the city's Civilian Police Review Board, William Nekaman, after the nomination was sat dormant for the last 6 months. The two-year term for League of Women Voters Board Representative Julia Holcomb expired in June, and Holcomb agreed to stay on the panel until a replacement was confirmed.
And those are all our headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
The Iroquois Pipeline Company is seeking a permit from the DEC to double the size of 4 toxic and noisy gas compressor stations that have long polluted working-class communities in Dover and Athens, New York. Nikki Cross of New York Lawyers for the Public Interest and Ben Schwartz of White Pine Community Farms talks to Mark Dunley about why climate activists want the project rejected.
The Iroquois Pipeline Company wants to drastically increase the amount of gas they push through their 37-year-old, 414-mile fossil gas pipeline running from the Canadian border to Long Island and New York City. They are seeking a permit from the Department of Environmental Conservation to double the size of 4 toxic and noisy gas compressor stations that have long polluted disadvantaged working class communities in Dover and Athens, New York. DEC is asking the public to submit comments. The Department of Public Service, Public Service Commission, wrote a letter saying the project is necessary, but DEC gets the final say regarding the project necessity. and whether it complies with our climate laws. And we're talking with Nikki Cross of the New York Lawyers for Public Interest and Ben Schwartz with the White Pine Community Farm down in Wendell. So what's the issue with the Iroquois pipeline?
So the Iroquois pipeline is about 40 years old. It was built with the most amount of violations of any fossil fuel project or fines besides the Exxon Valdez spill, which received more fines. It was incredibly controversial 40 years ago and was severely punished for violations, but they just took it sort of as a cost of doing business because they wanted to get it in. And it has never been renovated, so it's still 40-year-old infrastructure. It's carrying natural gas, which is notorious for leaking. And then I guess I'll just add that the pipeline company is planning to double the size of the three compressor stations, I believe, Nikki.
Four stations.
There you go. Four compressor stations, and double the amount of gas being forced through this really old pipeline that was built in a really poor way from the beginning.
So what are the problems with compressor stations? You know, why would local community residents be concerned about, you know, building out compressor stations?
So compressor stations pose huge risks to the public's health. They release mass amounts of pollutants, including carcinogens and pollutants that cause pulmonary diseases, asthma, and premature death. And right now, Iroquois is planning to double the capacity of these compressor stations and pump twice as much pollutants into the air. And these are really concentrated in around the compressor stations, which in New York are at Athens and Dover. And Ben is from Dover and runs a farm there. They also have a negative effect on crops. So these are really dangerous situations. And not only is it bad for the health of the people directly around the compressor stations, but we'll be releasing twice as many greenhouse gases in the air, which will further exacerbate climate catastrophe and lock us into further catastrophe at a time when we really can't afford it.
Maybe you could take a little time to explain what is the regulatory process. Understand this is multi-state, perhaps as much as four states. So, you know, which is the agency that actually, you know, makes a decision about the expansion? And where in the process are we at this point?
Right. So because Iroquois is trying to double its capacity, it has to apply for air state facility permits. And it does so through DEC. And DEC, just by standard practice, releases draft permits once the applying company submits a permit request. So now DEC has released the permit and at this point is calling for comments from the public about its assessment of whether or not this project is needed.
And I just want to add that we received concerning news that Nikki, can you, it's the New York State Utility Regulation sort of committee, a department that regulates energy in New York State. They're saying that, you know, New York City needs more gas, which is kind of crazy because New York City just banned any new infrastructure being fueled by gas or any new gas stoves. So it's sort of an indicator that the DEC is leaning towards okaying this project.
Right. So what actually happened is DEC sent a letter to DPS, which is the Department of Public Services. And DEC asked DPS whether or not this project was needed, just from a standpoint of, you know, how much gas will be needed in the coming years. And DPS gave an assessment that we think is based on flawed analysis that is short-sighted and not in keeping with our climate laws. And we think that there really is no need for this project. So DPS gave its assessment, and now DEC is calling for comments on it. We think that DPS's assessment is based on outdated modeling, and it doesn't account for the CLCPA, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. And it doesn't account for viable ways to meet other short-term needs for gas. And basically, DPS's forecasts are based on temperatures that have not occurred in nearly a century and are increasingly unlikely because of climate change. They don't account for the fact that demand will peak in the next 3 to 4 years. And that's when the project is expected to be completed by 2027 by Iroquois' own estimate. And at that point, demand will begin a steady decline. So DPS isn't accounting also for the legally required and necessarily rapid transition away from fossil fuels. The CLCPA requires drastic reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, and we're taking steps to meet those mandates, including, as Ben mentioned, through the electrification of buildings, which are the number one greenhouse gas emitter, at least in New York City. In October, Governor Hochul announced the largest state investment in renewable energy in US history, enough to deliver 12% of New York's electricity needs by 2030. And basically, DPS's incentive is to look out for its own interests and conduct business as usual, and to give itself a wider margin of error than the rest of us can afford.
I mean, we have had several people on talking about the New York Heat Act, which, among other things, would try to get DPS or the Public Service Commission to more align with the CLCPA. But I know that DEC under the CLCPA has been a little bit better. I know they stopped the Dan Scammer permit, which is, I guess, on the other side of the county across the river. So in the last 90 seconds or so, if people want to, you know, find out more about this project or submit some comments, you know, what's the deadline and how can they do that?
Right. So
go ahead.
Yeah. So grassroots organizations like Concerned Citizens of Dover, which Ben is a part of, and a coalition of over 300 environmental organizations called New York Renews, are calling for the public to submit comments to Governor Hochul and DEC, telling them to deny the permits because it's for a project that we don't need, and it will violate our climate laws and harm communities' health. It'll create another sacrifice zone for something we don't need. So what people can do if they're interested is submit comments. They can Google Hochul deny the permits and then click through the links to get to the Action Network and submit comments through there. And they need to do this by April 29th, the end of the month.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Nikki Cross, New York Lawyers for the Public Interest, and Ben Schwartz, White Pine Community Farm. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was Mark Dunley talking with Nikki Cross and Ben Schwartz about the Iroquois Pipeline Company's new project. Comments on the project can be made to the DEC at www.actionnetwork.org.
On March 19th, tenants from across New York had a rally at the state capitol to advocate for policies including the Good Cause Eviction and the Housing Access Voucher Program. Lennox Aputo was on the scene and talked with Robin Martin about the challenges that people with disabilities face while navigating the current rent crisis.
On March 19th, during the New York State tenant takeover of the Capitol in Albany, I had a conversation with Robin Martin, who shed some light on the difficulties of navigating the current housing/rent crisis for individuals with disabilities.
My name is Robin Martin. and I'm here to lift up the weaker people with disabilities, people that's homeless, people that don't have enough income because there's not enough jobs. So, I know about God's abundance. Help us stop wasting taxpayers' money. I'm a retiree. I can't afford this high rent.
So for today's event, it's in Albany, but there's people from across the state. And I was wondering if you could mention what part of New York you're from and what the state is like with the rent, the housing.
Well, I'm from Bronx, New York. And it's very, 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 very crowded. There is housing in the five boroughs. Plenty of housing. Skip the shelters and put people straight in the housing. Why are you wasting money on shelters? To have people sitting back waiting for housing. Put people straight into the houses. Put them straight into your apartments. End this reckless behavior that you're owning up to oppress the people. The Bible said the poor will always be with you. So what do you think God wants you to do with the poor?
And in your introduction, you also did mention that you're here to represent the needs of the people with disabilities in terms of the rent. And I was wondering if you could shed some light of the experiences that disabled people are having with, especially with, you know, not just for being able to afford rent, because on some occasions, because of disability, people cannot even work. So, and what's it like for people who are disabled to go through even the public housing system?
Well, let me tell you, I have a daughter that's schizophrenia bipolar, and I have another daughter that's mentally retarded. And both of them are having housing issues because they can't afford proper rent, so they have to go and live in areas that's dangerous. You're putting my grandchildren in danger. My mentally ill daughter is running around in the streets with no housing, no direction, no nothing. I have a family member that has HIV. Rent is too high for her to pay the rent. Stop messing up the money. You want to cut something? Cut y'all's paychecks.
And I'm sorry about hearing about the experiences of your daughters. And you, because you also mentioned a cut, and that the cut should be on the salaries of politicians. And the thing about, you know, for example, today some people are advocating for a program called the Housing Access Voucher Program. That's basically going to help people who cannot afford rent by subsidizing the cost of the housing. But then you'll hear other people push back on it by saying that if the government is going to subsidize housing, it means that they're going to have to tax the individual more. And so I'm wondering, what would you say to someone who is concerned about such a policy because they do not want to pay more taxes?
Well, you're being blessed with the money, so why not pay your taxes? You want us to pay something that we don't have. Where is the love? Where is the love? Where is the compassion? Some people got 4 and 5 houses. Other people have none. That ain't right. And I'm not just talking about this United States. I'm talking about all over the world. God has made provisions because he said, I will supply all of your needs, not some. He said all. So that makes me know, generations to generations, God will provide. So stop. Stop the oppression. Stop the oppression. Israel, stop the oppression. Africa, stop the oppression. United States, stop the oppression. There's enough money. There's enough money. It's God's money, not ours.
And Robin, when you're given your feedback, you did mention that some individuals have 4 or 5 houses while other people do not have any houses. And that points to an issue of inequality, you know, an unequal distribution of, you know, wealth across society. Right. And very often, another thing that you'll hear from people that might have more, you know, material wealth than other people is that they worked hard to earn that money without understanding that some individuals, maybe because of disability or for some other reasons, might not be able to even work to earn the most basic amount of money for any sort of upkeep. And so my question is, in terms of like making society more equal, because you mentioned love, you mentioned compassion, which are things that would help us in that direction.
So let me mention right rent, right building. 100-year-old buildings do not deserve high rent. Some of these buildings are falling down right on our heads. Fix it, fix it, fix it. Housing inspectors, do your job. Stop lying. You're hurting people. Government, y'all are hurting people for no reason. Do it right. God is watching you.
And my last question is, do you have anything to add that I might not have asked when we were having this conversation? Something else?
I do have something to add. I was homeless. And I told the worker that I was 29 years clean from drugs. And I told her I did not want supportive housing because I don't need supportive housing. She put me in supportive housing anyway. Now I'm surrounded by a bunch of drug addicts and drug dealers in my neighborhood, and I'm just afraid.
I'm sorry about that, Robin. And so in situations where, you know, for example, an individual like you did not ask for to be put in housing but were still put in that situation, what is the procedure of you? Is there like a process of appeal? Like, can you appeal your case? Can you... What options does someone in your situation have to, you know, be able to move from that dangerous situation, unsafe situation, to a more better situation?
Well, the only thing I know to do is go back into the system again. I stop paying rent because I'm unhappy. I'm unhappy.
I'm sorry.
I'm not going to use again. I don't want to use again. I shouldn't be put in that position. I shouldn't be. My sobriety is in danger.
I'm sorry, Robin.
The neighborhood is riddled with drug addicts and drug dealers. You're opening up shops. Why are you opening up drugs to be free? What good is it going to do for the United States to start making drugs free?
I'm sorry.
It's another suppression. It's not right.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Yes.
I know it took a lot of heart. It took a lot of strength to be able to do that. But we're hoping that through your story, as well as the stories of a lot of other people that I've talked to today, who have decided to come together and ask for, you know, to be treated fairly, that we'll be able to make society more just, we'll be able to get people access to housing. And thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
That was Lennox Saputo talking with Robin Martin at the rally at the state capitol on March 19th. Thank you to Robin for taking the time to interview us, or taking the time to talk to Lennox. This is the second interview Lennox Saputo did at the capitol. You can find the first one on our website at www.mediasanctuary.org.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazilaiki.
And I'm Jacob Austin. You are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Choi, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Choi, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Shore, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
Get your thinking caps on, guys. It is time for our weekly game of disability trivia. In today's episode, Blaze Bryant is joined by Max Rodriguez, Manager of Government Affairs with the Center for Disability Rights.
Joining me is Max Rodriguez, Manager of Government Affairs for the Center for Disability Rights. Hey, Max, thanks for hopping on the show with me here. How's everything?
Hey, Blaze, thanks for having me. Things are good.
Good to hear. So what's new in the Center for Disability Rights land that you care to share with us in terms of the advocacy and stuff you're working on?
Oh, you know, smack dab in the middle of budget season, which is always fun for, you know, the people who are interested in that. Right now, you know, we're just really fighting to try to save the consumer directed program. It's top of the list. Unfortunately, there's some bad actors in the program and a lot of misunderstanding about the good the program does and how essential it is to so many people.
For sure. And it's really amazing how in 2024, not just here in New York State, but around the country, there's talks of cutting home care programs that actually help people with disabilities live the lives they want to live.
Yeah, it's just insane to me that like that's even a question or a conversation to be having in 2024. It's like, you know, like I said, these are essential services. People need these. Without programs like Consumer Directed, people end up in nursing homes, hospitals, and other places where nobody should really be.
Right, all because they're not getting the care that they need. And it's, you know, and the other part of it too is the home care worker wages are just not where they need to be either.
It's really too bad when you look at where the wages are. I think a lot of it comes down to the misconception that this is unskilled labor. That couldn't be farther from the truth. This is highly skilled labor. Yeah, you know, it really is just too bad, you know, knowing that you can make more money at McDonald's, Target, than actually providing, you know, these services.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, we'll continue to have these conversations here. Now let's get into the trivia. I should note that we tried this last week and due to tech stuff, it didn't work. So I promise, Max, new questions and whatnot, it's going to work this time.
All right, I have faith in that.
All right, good. See, we have to have faith in something. Otherwise, as advocates, we just get all depressed and crap. So first question here is a true false, and you know how this works. If you get it right, I play a cash register sound. If not, well, you get the classic buzzer. So question number one, April is Medicaid Awareness Month.
That sounds true.
It sounds true, and in fact, it is. So you are one for one, my friend.
All right, there we go. It's a good start.
Yes, and it's not just the Consumer Directed Program that you've talked about here, Max Rodriguez. It's also Medicaid in general. The governor and other governors around the country are trying to cut because there's just this common misconception that it's only for people who need it because of poverty or they're just taking advantage of the program.
Yeah, you know, and it's really too bad. A lot of what it comes down to is, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And, you know, the top reason you always hear people want to slash, you know, programs like this is to save money. But, you know, you might be saving a dollar today, but when you're cutting services from people who need them, you're just going to cause a larger problem, you know, down the line, and it's going to be a much more expensive problem.
You're absolutely right. So you're one for one. Let's see if you can be two for two here. So this Michigan-born singer who is blind had their first hit when they were 12. Was it Ray Charles, Stevie Wonder, or Stevie Nicks?
Well, I definitely know it's not Stevie Nicks. Let's see. I'm going to go with Stevie Wonder.
Two for two, my friend. Well done.
There we go.
Yes, and Ray Charles was born in Georgia, I do believe.
That makes a lot of sense. I believe he has a song about that.
Yes, and he did have Georgia on his mind quite a bit. I couldn't resist making that little reference there. Now, Max, it's baseball season. Baseball is far and away my favorite sport. So I wanted to ask you about an adapted game called Beep Baseball, which is played by blind people. Now,
I like the way that sounds.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in Beep Baseball, how many bases are there? Two, three, or four?
This is the first time I'm hearing about this game. And I want to say, I mean, there's three bases, not including home base, in regular baseball. So, you know, let's just go with three.
Unfortunately, my friend, it is two bases. It is just first and third base.
So how does the game played?
So the way
I'm very interested.
Yeah, and I've played the game quite a few times. The way the game is played is the batter is blindfolded. The six position players are blindfolded, and the pitcher is actually on your team, not the opposing team. And when you hit the ball, you run to either first base or third base, whichever one is beeping, and that's controlled by what's called a base operator. There's a switch that they flip, and if it is to the right, usually it's first base, and to the left, it's third. And if you get a run, or if you get to the base before the fielder grabs the ball, it's a run. If not, it's an out.
So are the fielders blindfolded?
Yes, each of the six fielders are blindfolded. And the ball beeps.
Oh, the ball beeps as well. Okay.
Yes, hence Beep Baseball.
Yeah, right? Okay. That's very interesting. Now, is there a place in the Capital Region somebody could play? Or?
Not really. The closest place is probably downstate on Long Island. There's a team called the Long Island Bombers.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, the sport catches on and we see some of these fields start popping up a little closer to home.
For sure. Well, there actually is every year the Beep Baseball World Series, and I actually got to play in it when it was in, Rochester. This was probably about
awesome.
7 years ago or better. Yeah, I had every intent on just going there and being a spectator, but what happened was one of the teams, they were short a player, and they said, hey, you want to join? And I was like, John Fogerty, okay, put me in, coach. I'm ready to play. Why not?
Anyway, how'd you guys do?
I really don't remember, but we did okay. I had five at-bats, and, I struck out 4 times and made out once. So my batting average was 0.
Oh, there you are. It sounds like a hell of an experience, though.
It really was. I had a lot of fun. Some of the most fun I've had in the blind sports world for sure. So, Max, well done. You got 2 out of 3 last week, and you got 2 out of 3 right this week. So, in the spirit of, well, it doesn't matter either way, because you still would have, you know, to make a baseball reference, a .667 batting average. So, well done.
Better than my little league average, so I'll take it.
And 667 points better than my high school baseball batting average. Well, Max, this was fun as always. Good to catch up with you, and thanks so much for hopping on the trivia segment here with me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thanks for having me on, Blaze.
Well, Jacob and I were comparing notes. We learned a little bit, and I think we got 1 or 2 right, but not all. This is Blaze Bryant with his disability trivia. We'll have more next week.
On Tuesday, April 16th, the film Spaces of Exception was screened at the Sanctuary for Independent Media, followed by a panel discussion with Indigenous and Palestinian community members. Elizabeth E.P. Press spoke to the directors of the film, Matt Peterson and Malik Rosamni.
Today we are talking to Matt Peterson and Malik Rosamni about their documentary, Spaces of Exception. The film is screening on Tuesday, April 16th at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in North Central Troy. It'll be followed by a panel discussion about the film. Spaces of Exception juxtaposes the struggles, communities, and spaces of Native American reservations and Palestinian refugee camps. And today, we are joined by Matt and Malik to talk about their film. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Malik, can you tell us a little bit more about Spaces of Exception and include why you called it Spaces of Exception?
Spaces of Exception comes out of a longer-term multimedia research project, if you will, called Native and the Refugee. And the purpose of that project was really to try to understand and build connections as much as we could between the experiences and histories and present-day realities of Palestinian refugee camps and Native reservations in the United States. And the reason for that is that we saw that there was kind of a broad similarity between the struggles of Palestinians and Native people in terms of the centrality of the question of land. And then we also saw a similarity in terms of the spaces, the reservation as this kind of extranational space that is kind of the product of a distinct history of displacement and genocide, but is also the kind of holder of a kind of quasi-sovereignty. We felt that there was a similar kind of dynamic. I grew up myself between the U.S. and Lebanon, so I'm not Palestinian or Native, but I was able to observe from the outside a kind of similarity within these spaces, or at least in terms of how they exist within the nation states in which they're located. And so we thought if we could go inside to these places and talk to people, it might be interesting to juxtapose them. And that's essentially what the movie is. It's a series of segments shuttling back and forth between the U.S., West Bank, and Lebanon. The reason it's called Spaces of Exception in part is an homage to Giorgio Agamben, who speaks about states of exception. We took this kind of idea of the state of exception, which in Agamben's idea is this period of time, basically, where law is suspended and politics becomes real, which is to say that the violent apparatus which makes states possible is enacted. Law is suspended, but then in doing that, new norms are created. It's time when law and politics fuse. His was primarily concerned with a temporal or a time-based. We wanted to look at it spatially. And we can see that, unfortunately, right now in Gaza, in terms of the complete suspension of any kind of international law and the full brute force of the Israeli state being displayed. And in that, I think, unfortunately, we're going to see the creation of kind of new forms of violence that could be applied even beyond Gaza, right? And it's important to note that Gaza is 2/3 refugees. So Gaza is really a series, for the most part, of large refugee camps. So that's not totally separate from what's going on today there.
Thank you for that, Malik. You mentioned this larger project, the Native and the Refugee. And Matt, I was wondering if you could just explain how spaces of exception sort of fit into your broader scope of work.
Yeah, so as part of the Native and the Refugee, we started back in 2014, we started making short films and videos, and we made about a dozen of them. Most of them are available on our website, thenativeandtherefugee.com. But part of that methodology was each time we would visit either a reservation or a refugee camp, we would make basically a short film just from that one trip. And then we would have this material to show as we were continuing to travel and visit different places and communities and kind of have these discussions back and forth about the concept and the ideas. But we also did writings. We've done essays. We put out a book about the Mohawk Warrior Society. And, you know, Roger Jock, who's going to join us at the screening, comes out of that lineage. So that was a kind of deeper dive into the Mohawk experience around Akwesasne, which is one of the reservations we focus on in the film, which is in upstate New York and borders Ontario and Quebec. So it kind of spans the border of the United States and Canada, so-called. So that was kind of one deeper dive into the context of the project. We really wanted to think of it like an interdisciplinary project, you know, a research project. But the film is included in that. We made, you know, this 90-minute feature-length documentary film, which is a more kind of concise encapsulation of a lot of our research and a lot of our visits that can travel around and is, you know, serves as a self-contained event and opening for a discussion. So we're grateful that, you know, it's been screening so much, in particular the last 6 months, because I think people have been wanting to learn more about Palestine in general and the refugee dynamic and the, you know, settler colonial process, but then in the experience of that, wanting to think about colonization in the United States and North America, and what are the kind of resonances between what we're currently seeing in Gaza and what we historically might have experienced or peoples might have experienced in North America. And I think that's what the film hopes to do, or the event on Tuesday hopes to kind of bring to light, is to think about those shared experiences and how do we have contemporary solidarity now with what's happening in Gaza, but then what is the kind of historic solidarity, if you will, or generational solidarity with the lands that, you know, we live on in the United States, thinking about the different violent processes that we know they happened, you know, but we're still learning about what that actually looked like or felt like, or how it was narrated in the media, how it was narrated by the government, etc. And I think the current and the historic, you know, in terms of Gaza and this kind of dynamic of North America is what we like to talk about, and how we can kind of bring that solidarity to light. But then, of course, you know, Native reservations still exist. They're not just this historic phenomenon. They're living communities, struggling communities, still fighting for sovereignty and self-determination. So to think about, you know, how does the solidarity exist in a contemporary way here as well? So, you know, we're grateful that Roger will join us on Tuesday to kind of hear about his work and his experiences. So, yeah, thanks for having the screening.
Yeah, and before the screening, you'll have the opportunity to do a Be the Media workshop, which goes into this idea of diving deeper into long-term media projects from 5 to 6 p.m. So thank you for doing that. And when you view this film, it really puts into context, as someone from the United States, sort of how we have our hand and funding this genocide currently in Gaza as the United States and providing arms and looking back at our colonial history. But you don't hit people over the head with this type of information. You sort of allow people to enter these spaces, these places. And I was wondering if you wanted to comment on that approach to your collaboration?
Absolutely. Coming off of what Matt was talking about, the idea of it being a multimedia research project, part of the idea of making many of the short films, partially to show them in both spaces and to have it be a kind of cumulative process, but it was also to have, you know, different kinds of genres. So some of the films are more experimental, some of them are more propagandistic, some of them are more journalistic, some of them are more kind of a sensory kind of approach that makes you feel like you're there, and the others are more kind of discursive. But with the feature film, what we were really trying to do was do two things. One is we really were trying to avoid a didactic kind of approach where we're telling you, you know, what to think or believe, but rather
we wanted to do two things. On one level, visually, we wanted to, we'll use cinema, sound, and vision to kind of reproduce as much as one can what those spaces feel like. And then the other aspect on a discursive level was to see what people's analysis was. So kind of talk to well-organized, thoughtful people working, living, existing in those spaces, what they think both of their situation from the point of view of the camp or the reservation, but as well as the entire struggle, right? The Native struggle or the Palestinian struggle. It wasn't so much to teach people about those spaces. It was more like to think through ideas with people in those spaces while reproducing a feeling of what it might mean to feel like physically being there. I think that, and that comes out of the fact that our work in that particular movie was supposed to reflect our actual process, because that's what we literally did. We went there, stayed there, was in that space and talked to people there.
Excellent. So yes, the screening is on Tuesday, April 16th at 7 p.m. at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Matt Peterson will be joining us, and Malik Razamni and Matt Peterson, thank you for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Ahead of that screening on April 16th at 5 p.m., there will also be a Be the Media workshop, creating a long-term media project, where Matt Peterson will be working with the small workshop to talk about that process. And we're very excited then for the film screening and panel discussion afterwards. And more information can be found at mediasanctuary.org.
In this week's episode of American Taste, Skidmore student Jordan Guzman reports on food insecurity and the importance of food banks.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to another radio story coming from Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm your host, Jordan, and tonight we have a special story to share with you that touches on the battle against food insecurity. Our journey begins in New York, where families and individuals face the daily struggle of putting food on their tables. The issue of food insecurity is real. Over 34 million people in the U.S. face hunger, and that includes 91 children, according to the organization Feeding America. Now, to just expand on that, according to the Office of the New York State Comptroller, in 2019 and 2021, approximately 1 in 10, or about 800,000 New York households, experienced food insecurity. Self-reported food insufficiency for New York households has risen since the summer of 2021, from a summer average of 7.3% to 10.8% by November 2022. Rates for New York households with children are even higher, increasing to 13.4% by November 2022. Nationwide rates are higher, 11% for all and 13.7% for households with children in November 2022. Now, I know that was a lot of information. However, there shines a glimmer of hope, which is food banks and pantries. Food banks are the lifeblood of many communities, providing vital support to those in need. They serve as a bridge between hunger and hope. According to Christopher M. Bacon and Gregory A. Baker, food banks served 46 million people in 2015. That number has only risen, as Feeding America says that over 53 million people use food banks and food pantries in 2021. Part of this increase can be explained by the COVID pandemic, which only exacerbated the current problems that we have. Today, I have the privilege of talking to someone who knows a lot about that, and it just so happens to be someone who works for the regional food bank.
Hello, can you introduce yourself before we start?
Sure. Hi, Jordan. My name is Carrie Leary. I am the Director of Agency Services here at the Regional Food Bank of Northeastern New York. Our food bank covers 23 counties in New York State. We go up to the Canadian border, the eastern border of New York, as far west as Otsego and Delaware counties, and then down bordering Westchester and New York City.
So can you just give me, a bit of a background of how you got to where you are? Why are you doing what you're doing? Have you always wanted to do something like this?
Sure. I actually started this about 20 years ago. I have a BS degree in dietetics nutrition. So about 20 years ago, I became a Just Say Yes to Fruits and Vegetables nutrition educator. Long term to means that I work with people who are SNAP eligible, trying to improve their nutrition, their cooking skills. And I did that for 8.5 years. And at that point, I then transitioned into a different role of the food bank, nutrition resource manager, where I primarily did food safety and nutrition workshops for our agencies now, and made sure that, you know, the food pantries are giving enough food, et cetera. And then almost a year ago, I became director of agency services.
To follow up on that, did you always want to be involved in food? That makes sense.
I have such a great mom, and she was such a good cook that I've been in the kitchen my entire life. And so, yes, I did always have that love of food.
So with your current role, what is that look like on a day-to-day basis?
Every day is different, which is honestly terrific. I might be talking to or visiting different agencies, whether to help them problem solve or address routine things. I might be creating or implementing workshops for our agencies on any number of topics. I might be involved in implementing grants because we do oversee a lot of grants, especially the grants that are directed by New York State. And of course, no director job is complete without lots of paperwork and reports.
So continue on. What would be like the most challenging part of what you do?
That's a good question. So one of the most challenging things is, as a food bank, we are donation driven. So that while agencies are able to purchase product from us, donations are just that, donations. So largely at the whim of the donor, we may not always be well stocked in different types of donations. So then the agencies have to use their funding to order the purchased food, which costs more. Despite that we have them at the right market value, donors have really tightened their belts, making that donated product so much less readily available for our agencies. So basically, it's costing our agencies a lot more to operate to serve the people in need.
How do donations vary throughout the year? Are there like certain points where you notice there are more donations versus others?
I know in terms of our volunteers are through the roof right now with the holiday season. Donations tend to be heavier this time of year near the holiday season. But you know what? People are hungry all year. Our food sourcing department works really hard year round trying to get in as many donations as possible.
So how exactly would somebody donate? How does that whole process work?
There's a number of different ways that people can donate. Whether it's individuals, we have people who walk food in our front door, which our volunteers then sort through and identify and then repackage in terms of category, not repackage the product. We have stores who may donate individual items or entire cases of product. Financial donations are huge. We have a lot of people who donate to the agencies as a line of credit here on account. And the purchasing power at the food bank for the agencies is about $10 for every $1 that they have.
So with all the donations that you get, for example, in terms of food, how do you guys like sort through like what food you can take, what food you can't take?
Excellent questions. So we do sort by the guidelines established by New York State Ag and Markets. Our volunteers are looking for a couple of different things. One, the date on the product. Please know that the food does not go bad on the date on the product. It is still good, safe, and high quality past that date. How far past that date depends on the type of product it is. So our volunteers have guidelines depending on the type of product, how long past that date we can accept that donation. But also they're looking at container integrity, because while some dents are okay, some dents are not. And we do want to make sure, while we are looking very much to divert land from the landfill, we of course want to provide safe quality food to people.
So is the food like canned foods, or does it matter specifically it's cooked or not?
We get everything. We have a lot of shelf stable product. We do get a lot of refrigerated and frozen donations as well. There are specific guidelines around cooked product in terms of, has it been served before, in which case absolutely not. Was it prepared in a licensed kitchen, etc.
So I guess Valong, do you roughly get the same amounts, the same types of foods across all food banks?
So every food bank is different. One, in terms of what they accept. Some have more stringent nutrition policies and accept very little of that product. Some are more willing to accept other things. Here at the Regional Food Bank, we have a very wide selection of food and non-food that's donated. Whereas many food banks have a smaller warehouse, therefore can accept less different types of product than we do.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So it really varies from food bank to food bank. To continue on, I mean, you've been in this industry for a long time. So I guess throughout the years you've been working, what have you enjoyed the most?
What interests me the most about this? You know, honestly, when I interviewed for the position of Just Say Yes to Fruits and Vegetables Educator, they asked me a question, and at the end it was like, you know, a palm to forehead, like, I can't believe I said that, but it is so true. I like to help people. And I said that in an interview and I thought I was doomed. But 20 years later, I'm not. I do really enjoy knowing that we are here to help people. You know, we have so much abundance in our country, but there is still so much need. But we can work together and we can help to bridge that gap.
I like that. So now that we're approaching the end of the interview, is there anything else you'd like to end off with?
I know one of the questions we often get is, how healthy is the food at the food banks? And, you know, it does vary, like I talked about. But food pantries and soup kitchens do have access to USDA TFAP commodity products. Mostly those canned vegetables are packed in no salt or they are low sodium. The canned fruits are most often packed in juice or water, making them healthier options for canned items. Food pantries and soup kitchens also have access to funding from New York State Department of Health, Division of Nutrition. That's HPNAP, Hunger Prevention Nutrition Assistance Program. They put restrictions on the amount of sodium and sugar in the food that is purchased. So it's not a free for all. We are looking out for the health of the people that we serve. And in 2022, we distributed more than 45 million pounds of product. And of that, fresh produce was more than 20% of that figure. And that's just incredible. We are really trying to get that fresh produce out to people. But overall, nearly 90% of what we distributed was staples, like fruits and vegetables, grains, dairy, meat, and other proteins. So we are really looking out for the health of people as well as trying to feed them.
Thank you for taking the time to have this interview.
Thank you very much.
That was another American Tastes story, this one from Skidmore student Jordan Guzman. And American Tastes is a course with Dr. Beck Crafting at Skidmore College, and their final project was these radio stories for us. That's why you've been hearing them every Friday night and Monday morning on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Boston. Our engineer is the incomparable Sina Bazila-Hickey. We thank all our volunteers who made today's episode possible. This is a team effort. Shouts to Mark Dunley, Lennox Aputo, Blaze Bryant, EP, and Skidmore student Jordan Guzman. We want to hear from you. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Mag, or send us an email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website and on your favorite podcast platform. And thanks to you, our listeners, for making this worthwhile.